Chapter 44. An Inspector Calls. I was checking through my account of the strange case of the woman who lost a sandal in Bohemia when the doorbell rang. Molly thundered along the hallway, and I heard an, "Oh, it's you!" And I hoped it was somebody who she was entitled to address in that way. She had once spoken to the Prince of Wales's equerry in an even more familiar fashion. I did not have to worry long, however, because she came bursting in with "Spectre Pound," flinging out her arm as if introducing a trapeze artist. "Thank you, Molly." I got up from the desk. "Good morning, Inspector. If you are looking for Mr. Gryce, he has been called as a professional witness in the trial of Beryl Cornett." The inspector looked uneasy, I thought. Did he have bad news?
"Actually, it is you I have come to see,"
he said, and Molly winked.
"Aye, aye,"
she gave him a big nudge. "Go away," I said in my most Grycean tones.
"But he's only just got here."
"I was talking to you."
"Oh,"
she tangled her fingers. "And do not eavesdrop," I warned, waiting for her to ask me what an eave was, and if it would break when she dropped it. But she only gave another pained but briefer,
"Oh,"
tied her fingers into granny knots, and clumped back towards the lower stairs.
"I have some good news," he told me.
"You do not look like you have." His face was pinched and anxious. Was he going away again? I realized with a pang that it was none of my concern any more.
"I am to be promoted," he announced, "in about 2 weeks' time. Newberg is retiring at last, and I am to take his place."
"Chief Inspector?" I resisted the urge to throw my arms round him. "But that is wonderful."
"I shan't be sorry not to be posted back to Limehouse."
He managed a fleeting grin. "Quigley must be eating himself," I crowed. "He thought the job would be his."
"He will have to accept it," Pound shrugged, "or leave."
"The latter would be too much to hope for." I touched his hand. "Oh, George, that is marvellous news." He smiled again, but still nervously.
"I hoped you would be pleased."
His clear blue eyes, the ones that Harriet said she could go boating in, were troubled. "Are you not?" I asked in consternation, and George Pound cleared his throat.
"I've been a fool, March."
He called me by my Christian name for the first time since we had separated at that graveside.
"A damned fool."
"What have you done?" I asked, praying that he had not gone off and married some horrible woman.
"Would you like to sit down?"
"No."
"I let you go, March."
He looked at his feet.
"And when you tried to come back to me, I turned you away. I was a damned fool."
At this point, Mr. G would have reminded the inspector that he had already established that point, but I only said, "What are you telling me?"
"I was worried about the gulf in our affairs, but mine are much improved now, though I will never be a wealthy man."
He glanced into my eyes. "I do not care about that."
"I know."
George Pound searched my face, and his big hand went to my cheek.
"When I thought I had lost you."
I put a finger to his lips. "You never lost me." And for the first time I saw those eyes glisten.
"I love you so much."
He went down on one knee.
"March."
"Don't," I said. And he looked at me in bewilderment. "Do not say it unless you mean it. Really mean it. And mean it forever."
"Will you marry me?"
"Oh, you bloody fool." I fell down on my knees and cradled his big, wise, strong, gentle face. "Of course I will." And the tears ran down George Pound's cheeks, and I kissed each one away until I could not see them for my own.
"Oh, law!"
Molly materialized with unnerving stealth.
"Has she fallen over again? What a crybaby!"
Molly served us tea on the first floor. George did not feel comfortable with the idea of sitting in Sidney Grice's armchair, and there was a sofa in the sitting room where we could sit together and look out on the street, but mainly at each other. "I shall get you well again," I promised, toying with the ring on my third finger.
"I am quite well now," he reassured me. "My wound burst, and it seemed that I would die, but the poison drained, and now it has completely healed."
"I should have been there with you." "I shall make you very well," I told him. "You have lost weight. I shall feed you up with beef and kidney pies and puddings and foaming pints of stout."
"It will be me that is stout," he warned.
"I hope so." I squeezed his hand. "And I shall cut and rub your tobacco and fill your meerschaum pipe and take you back to Parbold and introduce you to my old friend, Maudie Glass, and show you all my childhood haunts." George snuggled closer.
"I shall ask Mr. Grice this evening," he vowed.
"Let me speak to him first." I kissed George. "You know what he is like."
"All too well,"
George agreed ruefully and pinched his philtrum. "Strictly speaking, he cannot forbid it," I said, "for he is not my legal guardian, but I should like his blessing."
"And so should I,"
George agreed heartily.
"I have a very high opinion of your godfather, and I should not like to come between you."
"Your sister will not be happy," I predicted.
"Lucinda will come round to the idea."
"I doubt it very much," I argued, with some feeling, for I did not care for Lucinda, and she detested me, blaming me, and not without reason, for her brother's being stabbed. He separated his thumb and forefinger to run them under his moustaches.
"She knows that I care for you, and I shall let her stay in our uncle's house. We can find somewhere to rent."
"I cannot promise to be an obedient wife," I warned, and George Pound put his arms round me.
"I should not believe you if you did."
"And I still want to be a personal detective."
"And I shall do everything I can to support you in that,"
he said, and I knew that he would. We sat a while, me nestling into his embrace. "Shall we have children?" It occurred to me that I did not even know if he liked them.
20,
he hugged me.
"Well, at least one, I hope."
2 would be nice. I kissed his palm. "It can be lonely, being an only child."
"Siblings are not always a blessing,"
George told me ruefully.
"But if you want 2, then 2 it is."
An omnibus drew alongside with a Sikh in crimson robes and matching turban at the back of the top floor, in splendid isolation. A warrior king aboard his chariot.
"I know how desperately you miss your fiancé,"
George said carefully.
"Your first fiancé, I mean. But I want you to make a promise to me, March. If anything happens to me..."
"I will not let it..."
"If it does,"
he insisted,
"you will not keep a shrine to me."
George put his hands to my face and turned it to look at him, and his gaze searched mine. "I promise," I said. "No shrine. And whilst we are on that subject, you asked me once what I would do if Edward could return." I felt his fingers tighten.
"It was not a fair question,"
he mumbled, and glanced out of the window. The Sikh stroked his beard and was gone. "You had every right to ask it," I insisted, "and I told you that I did not know, but I would like to answer it now. You are not a substitute, George Pound. You are not second best. If I had to choose between you, it would be you without hesitation." I had thought that I would feel guilty saying that aloud, for I had loved Edward with all my heart. But that heart had been broken, and George Pound had mended it. And now it almost burst with love for the man with whom I would share my life.